You are listening to Feminist Current. I'm Megan Murphy. Women's bodies have always been the focal point of patriarchy. Whether we are forced to reproduce or offered birth control so we can be sexually accessible, liberals and conservatives alike both ensure women don't have bodily autonomy. As a result of patriarchy, women's knowledge of and control over their own bodies has been wrested from them. We are forced to depend on male legislators, a male-dominated medical establishment, and the pharmaceutical industry. And women-centered knowledges and practices like self-abortion, menstrual extraction, other alternative forms of birth control, and women-centered birth practices are no longer common knowledge. While feminism has fought for women's reproductive rights, for access to things like abortion and the pill, Mary Lou Singleton says we need to look beyond rights and towards sovereignty. Mary Lou is a midwife, nurse practitioner, and reproductive sovereignty activist. I had the pleasure of watching her present at this year's Wolf Fest and spoke with her over the phone last week from her home in New Mexico. Here's that interview. So I was so impressed and inspired by your presentation at Wolf Fest last weekend and have lots and lots of questions. But first, I'd be interested to hear about the work that you do and how you came to that work.
Sure. I currently practice as a family nurse practitioner, and I do primary health care for whole families, for pregnant women, infants, young adults, adults and elders. So I recently transitioned into that after 20 years practicing as a home birth midwife, and I wanted to provide full spectrum primary health care, and that's what I do now. I have an integrative health clinic that I'm an herbalist. I have an herb pharmacy here. I help people, you know, with all aspects of their health in a primary care setting.
And how did you get involved in midwifery?
Right. So my whole life, from the time I can remember, I wanted to help women have babies. And I was told, I remember very clearly being told, first I was told that's a man's job. And then by people who were more supportive, I was told that means you want to be an obstetrician. And I was always really good at school, and I was tracked for med school literally from first grade. You know, I sort of knew I was going to go to med school from the time I was like 7 years old. All of my high school decisions were made based on this idea I was going to go to med school. I went to college thinking I was going to go to medical school. And then in all with the intention of helping women have babies. And then in college, I took an anthropology class called Sex and Culture. And I learned about midwifery for the first time. I learned about midwifery in a contemporary context. And it was like a classic light bulb experience. This is what I've always wanted to do. I just didn't know it existed. So I immediately shifted gears and started putting all my energy into becoming a midwife and trained with several midwives around the country, and then eventually ended up in New Mexico and studied here and became a licensed midwife and practiced for 20 years doing home births.
Now, the conversation around reproductive rights today is almost completely dominated by, one, access to abortion, and two, access to the pill or other forms of hormonal birth control. What is your perspective on that conversation? You know, is there anything that's missing?
Yes, I think there's a lot missing about what's true reproductive sovereignty for women. I think that at least in the United States, and I think this is true for most Western countries, there's this left-right polarization. This in the United States is framed as like a liberal-conservative dichotomy. And the liberal people are fighting for, like you said, more access to birth control, access to abortion. Conservative people are fighting to end abortion rights. Many of them are fighting to criminalize birth control. As I have grown and matured in the fight for women's reproductive sovereignty, I kind of stepped back and realized, like, this is liberal patriarchy and conservative patriarchy having, like, kind of jostling about how they want to control the women. And I do think that liberal perspective of birth control and abortion, a lot of that is informed by male ruling class forces that want women to be sexually accessible without consequences to men, and also want to control the population. There are people in the ruling class who really want to lower the population, and they tend to really push for more birth control for all women, forcing birth control on people, especially poor women, women of color, women in the non-Western world, and then limited abortion freedom. They never push for abortion on demand and without apology. It's not really true abortion freedom. And then the conservatives, it seems like these ruling class men want this huge, desperate population that will work for slave wages, and they don't want anyone to have birth control or abortion because they want more people, because desperate people are easier to control, and also have this religious perspective of the traditional patriarchal family where women are owned by one man in the marriage contract and reproduce heirs for him.
Mm-hmm. You use the term reproductive sovereignty, not reproductive rights or even reproductive justice. What does reproductive sovereignty mean?
To me, reproductive sovereignty means women understanding that we're completely sovereign over our bodies. That's somewhat redundant. It means women's health in women's hands. And it means that all decisions about reproduction are made by the woman herself in a full context where that woman is free of patriarchal forces who are coercing decisions and choices. So to get full reproductive sovereignty, we have to dismantle patriarchy. I believe to dismantle patriarchy, we have to dismantle capitalism, where women are the means of production of new people. And if we've done that, then we can come to this place. The goal of women having true freedom over their own reproduction, being sovereign in our lives.
Mm-hmm.
And part of what it also means to me is moving past this authoritarian model where women are trained to believe that our bodies are scary, our bodies are dangerous, we need authority figures to save us from our bodies. In true reproductive sovereignty, women trust their bodies. We know that certain things can happen where we might need access to experts who can help us, but for the vast majority of our reproductive functions, we and our friends can take care of it.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Now, a huge problem with the reproductive rights movement and the conversation around reproductive rights is that we're allowing both our rights as women and our reproductive health, you know, so our bodies, to be controlled by the medical establishment, as you've just talked about a little bit, and the pharmaceutical industry. How did this happen? You know, what did women do before these industries took over in terms of their reproductive capacity, their pregnancies, their reproductive health, etc.?
Right. There's a great book that people should read, especially if they're interested in how this happened in the United States, called When Abortion Was a Crime. And the author's last name is Reagan, like Reagan, the terrible president. I can't remember her first name. So When Abortion Was a Crime, the author's last name is Reagan. And that book details the rise of the consolidated medical industry and the destruction of women's reproductive sovereignty in the United States. And she really elaborates on how when physicians who are now medical doctors took over all of medicine, they criminalized all the other kinds of providers of healthcare. So they didn't like herbalists. They criminalized chiropractors for a while. There were eclectic physicians who didn't believe in the current model that we have that practiced differently. They were also criminalized. They were moving away from plant-based medicine to industrially produced chemicals as medicine. And one of their biggest threats to doing this was midwifery, where women were doing so much of the healthcare, because midwives in communities, every community had midwives. Midwives didn't just help women have babies. They were the women went to when fevers were too high for the mom's comfort level, when bones were broken, when someone had skin problems, when there were abscesses, when, you know, any health issue, the midwives took care of that. And those women also were the women who helped people with their dying processes and with death rituals. So the midwives were really integrated into their communities, and women trusted their midwives, and even men trusted midwives. This was in a time before antibiotics, before, this is like when people were just learning to, like, you know, wash your hands before you do surgery. Like, this is before blood transfusions. People knew you were much more likely to die in that industrial hospital system than if you stayed out of it, especially for childbirth. And there was this problem of, how are we going to get rid of the midwives? Well, at this time, it's also before there was any kind of industrial birth control. Birth control was abortion. And in this book, it really documents looking at women's diaries and newspapers from cities that advertised menstrual regulation services, that abortion was incredibly common. It was birth control for women. There were many women having multiple abortions, though they weren't even considered that. Pregnancy wasn't considered real until you started to feel the fetus move. So it was considered regulation of the menses to end an early pregnancy, and the midwives were the primary providers of that. So the way the medical industry got rid of midwives was by criminalizing abortion. And that was very effective, because abortion has always been this shameful private thing. And women would get out in the streets and defend the midwife for, you know, I've had 8 births with her, she's great, everything was safe. People kept quiet about abortions and let the midwives be taken away and criminalized for providing abortion services. So the criminalization of abortion was about the destruction of autonomous midwifery and women's reproductive sovereignty.
And while obviously I want all women to have easy, free access to abortion in medical clinics whenever they like, but what we're not talking about is the fact that self-abortion is actually not as difficult or dangerous as it's made out to be. What are the ways that women can self-abort? And, you know, how can women learn how to conduct abortions on themselves or on other women?
Well, luckily, our foremothers have been through this fight before, and also saw some of these changes happening as, you know, we went from having some abortion freedom to losing that abortion freedom. So there's a lot of great literature and a lot of great resources out there for women to find these skills. One of my favorite is called A Woman's Book of Choices, and it's written by Carol Downer and Rebecca Chalker. And these are women, they interview women, and they themselves are women who had illegal abortions and had self-induced abortions, and they tell it straight what women were doing. In that book, they detail cervical massage, which is a really interesting form of abortion I didn't know about until I read that. It's a form of abortion, self-abortion, that really works best for women who've already had a child, where the cervix is a little more open, and a woman can put her hands inside her vagina and reach up and feel her cervix and find the opening of the cervix and just dilate and dilate and dilate, like mess with it until it's more open and more open and more open. And that will almost always induce a miscarriage. And they have a large body of anecdotal stories of women who self-induced abortion with that before Roe versus Wade. It was a pretty common method. They also detail menstrual extraction, which is a method I find really exciting and interesting. That came out of Carol Downer's group. She was one member of a group in LA where their whole mission was women's health in women's hands. And menstrual extraction is a method where a group of women together extract the contents of the uterus with gentle suction. A Woman's Book of Choices has instructions on how to do that. It has how to assemble the equipment. It talks about safety, how to make sure this is something that you're doing correctly. So those are two methods. Another method that a lot of women are using, which is less in our hands because of the pharmaceutical industry, is the drug called misoprostol, or Cytotec, which is a drug that was originally designed to prevent stomach ulcers, but it's a strong prostaglandin, and it causes uterine contractions and expulsion of what is inside the uterus. Many women right now are buying misoprostol online and using that to self-abort. There's a Dutch organization called Women on Waves that has information for women in countries where abortion is not accessible of how to do that safely. Womenonwaves.org details how to do a safe misoprostol abortion and has some information on how to access that medication. That's a little less exciting to me because we're still dependent on the pharmaceutical industry, which is something women certainly do not control. And then that leads to the issue of the drug called RU486 or Mifeprex, which is this incredibly safe medication. It's a progesterone blocker that safely and very reliably induces abortion, especially if it's used with misoprostol. But there's a total lockdown on that medication. It's really odious when you look at how that medication is controlled. It's like the only medication I know of in the United States where there's only one distributor, and providers like myself who have prescriptive privileges would have to apply to get it from this one distributor, prove that we can legally do abortions in our state, and then we get one dose at a time. Or if you're a bigger clinic and they've determined you're allowed to have more, you're allowed to have more, but it's completely up to them. It's not like penicillin where I can order as much as I think I need for my clinic. And then every dose has to be accounted for with demographic information on the woman you gave it to and what the outcome was. So they're collecting information on women through it too. And that's infuriating to me because that is an incredibly safe medication. I think it should be sold over the counter. I'm really, really disgusted that there's such a lockdown on this medication that's so safe, but because it effectively, safely, easily induces abortion, women can't access it.
Mm-hmm. And as I mentioned earlier, there's a real big focus on the right to the birth control pill and how important the birth control pill is to women's liberation and in the feminist movement and things like that. What do you think about the pill, and what's your perspective or critique of popular birth control methods in general?
Well, you know, I need to premise by saying I don't want any birth control methods to be illegal, and I don't want to do anything that feeds into right-wing and conservative efforts to remove those options from women. So that being said, at the beginning, personally, I don't think the birth control pill is good for women. And I certainly don't think the long-term, the long-acting reversible contraceptives like the IUD and the implants are good for women. I think that these medications have very serious side effects. They have very serious risks. The hormonal birth control affects every cell in a woman's body. Any woman who's taken the pill can attest to how it affects our moods. We all realize that. I think what's most horrifying to me about the pill and other hormonal contraceptions is that all of those methods, a very, very common side effect, more women get it than don't get it, is a complete suppression of libido. And that, I think that should be really scary to women, like the Stepford-esque aspects of that, of chemically neutering us, taking away our libido, and making us sexually accessible to penis and vagina ejaculatory intercourse. So I think there are a lot of problems. I would love to see a more widespread critique of hormonal birth control on the part of the radical feminist movement, because I don't think it's good for women. There are studies from the 70s and 80s that the safest method of birth control for women is using barrier methods and natural family planning and withdrawal with abortion, early abortion, as backup. But because we're all brainwashed to think that abortion is so terrible, it has to be avoided at all costs, it's the most horrible thing, to be responsible, you have to sterilize yourself, at least temporarily, women can't think straight about it, you know?
And what about, you know, the IUD? I think a lot of women who have decided that the pill isn't right for them because it has an impact on their moods or their bodies or their libidos, or they don't feel comfortable taking hormonal birth control, they don't feel comfortable taking a pill every day, have opted for the copper IUD. Do you think that's a good alternative?
Well, again, I don't want that option to be taken away from women. But I do think the copper IUD is it's uncomfortable for most women. The IUD insertion process is a very uncomfortable experience for women. It's usually painful for them. It's interesting to me, having observed a few vasectomies and having inserted hundreds of IUDs, how a vasectomy is actually less uncomfortable, quicker procedure than an IUD. So there's, you know, there's this normalization of being female means you have to go through painful things when you get an IUD. And then when you have the copper IUD, even though you're not being affected by hormones every second of every day like you are with the hormonal methods, there's a constant level of inflammation in the uterus happening by having that foreign object in there. And I really worry about what that does to women's immune systems. I know anecdotally many, many women who say that they developed autoimmune issues and chronic pain issues very soon after getting an IUD or within a few years of getting an IUD. Some of them, their symptoms significantly improved after taking the IUD out. So there's that aspect of what does that do to put a foreign body inside a woman versus vasectomy, where it's just like a quick little incision and snip. There's that man doesn't have to live with that. And I understand those are, you know, vasectomy is permanent and IUD is temporary, but just to contrast what women are expected to put up with versus what men refuse to put up with. Mm-hmm. And then the copper IUD usually causes very heavy, crampy, painful periods. And that can lead to anemia, loss of work, loss of income, just debilitation, depression from having, you know, a 10-day period where you're bleeding the whole time. So it's not a benign thing to do to a woman.
I've seen feminists who advocate against, or, you know, not against hormonal birth control, not, you know, like you say, feminists are not advocating to make the pill inaccessible or illegal. They want women to have options. But feminists who have critiques of hormonal birth control and who advocate towards alternatives like the Rhythm Method or tools like DAISY, which is a fertility tracker, I've seen these feminists attacked pretty badly by liberal feminists in the U.S. You know, Amanda Marcotte, for example, called Holly Griggs-Ball's work on this issue bizarre and half-baked. And, right. You know, why do you think liberal feminists are so incredibly dismissive and to the point where they're, you know, attacking the legitimate work of these feminists? Why are they so dismissive of critiques of birth control and of big pharma and of medical interventions in women's reproductive health more broadly?
I wish I understood why people fall for liberal marketing that sells us something that's not necessarily empowering. I wish I had the answer to that. I think that it falls into everything that, you know, because the personal is political and vice versa with women, everything we're engaging with, every way we're engaging with patriarchy, when we start to critique how we're being forced to engage with patriarchy and the choices we're making in that engagement, inevitably people's feelings get hurt. And it's always interpreted as like my analysis of how the pill is not actually good for women gets read as, why are you hating on women who take the pill? Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
So I think there's some of that classic liberal radical dynamic going on there. And then I think it's deeper that women have enormous medical allegiance to the medical industry. Women have enormous allegiance to that system of medicine. And we're all brainwashed into it from the time we're really young, that the pill was this liberation, that the doctors can help us, that we can be rescued from our bodies, that our moms almost died in childbirth, that thank God for medicine, thank God for pain relief, that people don't want to disengage from what in many ways is an abusive relationship with big pharma and big medicine, because we all know what that's like when women start to come to consciousness of an abusive relationship. Often the reaction is to defend the abusive relationship further. So I think that's also going on. Holly Griggs Ball, in her work, she says that she really thinks the pill has addictive qualities to it, that women get addicted to these drugs in the sense of becoming physically dependent on it, having withdrawal when they stop it, feeling as though they can't live without it. So that's probably leading to some of the allegiance as well.
Yeah, I mean, I think you're, the first point you made is relevant in a number of ways in terms of those debates between liberals and radicals. You know, that critique of a system or critique of the norm, but a norm that's been accepted by mainstream feminism, is construed as an attack or as judgment or as shaming. And so, you know, maybe some women get defensive because they've made these choices that are now being critiqued, or have been critiqued for some time. I shouldn't just say now. I wanted to get back to midwifery for a little bit, because there are some controversies that have happened in that field recently. And one of those controversies is the issue of men in the profession. I've noticed that there have been a few men here and there who are entering into the midwifery profession. And I wonder what you think about that.
Well, personally, I believe midwifery is a women's tradition and men have no place in it. That's what I think about it. I think that once midwifery got professionalized and stopped being women's health in women's hands and became a capitalist profession, it was inevitable that men would want to colonize that and get in on that. You see the same thing with nursing. Like, once nursing became a respectable profession where you could make a decent living, suddenly there's this influx of men. So I think part of it is it's a job now, and that makes it very difficult to defend why you believe in sex discrimination and who gets to do that job. So part of it's that. Part of it is men have always wanted to control birth. It's the whole root of patriarchy that men want their, you know, they want credit for the magic birthing power. And I think a lot of men attracted to midwifery are patriarchal men, often patriarchal men who call themselves feminists, who want credit for what women do.
Mm-hmm.
That's going to get me in trouble.
And another controversy is in terms of this new trend of using gender-neutral language to discuss women's reproductive capacity and women's bodies in general. So organizations like Planned Parenthood and some midwifery organizations have begun to use gender-neutral language like menstruators or pregnant people in order to, it appears, in order to accommodate and be inclusive of trans-identified people. What do you think about this language? How do you think that using gender-neutral language to discuss reproductive health and women's bodies and reproductive rights impacts women and the feminist movement more broadly?
Well, I think it's very concerning, and I think that a lot of well-meaning people are pushing this, not really stepping back and looking at what gender ideology really means in terms of our ability to describe and fight patriarchal oppression and our ability to name sex-based oppression. But I think that most of the people within midwifery pushing this are very well-meaning people who truly want to be inclusive. And then some of them are just people who want to be cool. Like, there's no question that gender ideology is being relentlessly marketed by big moneyed forces. Like, there's nothing grassroots or subversive about this. It's being marketed so heavily. You know, People Magazine selling it, Good Housekeeping is selling it. I wish liberals could step back and understand, like, if Good Housekeeping selling it, it's not about women's liberation, mm-hmm. You know? So, but people are falling for that marketing because it's so brilliant that it's being marketed as the right way to think. It's being marketed as cool. So we see this a lot in capitalism, a commodified cool. And people don't step back and look at the forces shaping this cultural phenomenon that's obviously prevalent, widespread, and well-funded. I think the biggest issue for me, what I would really like people who are at all on the fence or willing to discuss why radical feminists have an issue with gender ideology, what I would really like them to consider is how it destroys our ability to describe sex-based oppression and how patriarchy developed and continues to be a system where male-bodied people control female-bodied people because of our ability to reproduce. And, you know, what I try to ask people is, you know, okay, if you want to have woman and female mean those things, like an identity now, okay, I would be willing to give you that if you can tell me, like, what is the name of the people that I fight for? I need a concise name for the group of people I fight for who are oppressed on the basis of biological sex. And these people are aborted in the womb because vulvas show up in ultrasounds. They're smothered in infancy because they don't have a penis. They're sold to men as rape and breeding slaves, and the world calls it child marriage. They are abducted by Boko Haram and forcibly impregnated and used as rape slaves there. In the United States, they suffer court-ordered cesareans, on and on and on. They're denied abortions. They go to jail for suspicious miscarriages. I need a concise name for that group of people. Could the genderists please offer me a concise name for that group of people? And if they can't, I'd like them to examine how it might be harmful to that group of people to no longer have a name for themselves and what they are collectively experiencing because they are of the female sex.
Mm-hmm. Now, you know, the reproductive rights movement in the U.S. is up against so much. You've discussed a lot of these issues, you know, the criminalization of women who miscarry, the criminalization of abortion, all this like false propaganda around abortion, and I respect what they're up against in the U.S. as well as in many other countries. But in many ways, you've talked about the way that what they're fighting for is misguided in terms of legislation and in terms of what genuine female empowerment would really look like. So what would you suggest advocating towards instead? You know, what should the reproductive rights movement in the U.S. be doing, really?
I think that the people within the reproductive rights movement in the United States who are interested in working politically on those structures really need to stop being apologetic about abortion. I think we need to go back to rallying for abortion on demand and without apology. I think we need to put pressure on primary healthcare providers and OBGYNs. Anyone who provides primary healthcare for female people should be offering abortion services in their practice. We shouldn't have this abortion ghetto where women have to travel 300 miles because all the providers in their town are too cowardly to offer abortion services. Again, like that rallying cry of abortion on demand and without apology. When people say to me, "Oh, that's too much, that's too much," I just respond, you know, if you disagree with abortion on demand and without apology, which women should be forced to gestate and give birth against their wills, and which women should be made to feel terrible about it? Because it's a very basic statement that is actually, you know, it's exactly what we need to be advocating for. Instead, we've fallen into this, oh, safe, it needs to be safe but rare, oh, abortion's always tragic, oh, abortion's so sad. Like, abortion should be like any other healthcare procedure. When you have a problem with your health, you can go get treatment for that problem. A lot of that treatment isn't pretty to watch. A lot of that treatment is stuff we'd rather the problem hadn't happened to begin with, but we're not like, oh, well, nobody really likes mastectomies, but sometimes that's necessary for, you know, if people get breast cancer. No one really likes to think about, you know, having tonsils removed. Like, this is, it's a medical procedure. We should stop apologizing for it. An unplanned, an unwanted pregnancy is a treatable medical condition. So at that level of people advocating for, like, social, political change, I'd like to see that. Just being unapologetic, really pushing for full spectrum healthcare for women with no restrictions. On a more radical level, I'd like to see more women learning about their bodies, rediscovering self-abortion. There is a growing home abortion movement, which I'm very excited about. About abortion, birth, we're social animals, and women especially are social creatures, like bees, like dolphins, like so many of our primate relatives. Abortion and birth are things that females do together. It's not, you have to break out of the individualism of capitalism. It's safer for you to do this with a friend. It's safer to do this with a sister because we're social animals, not because our bodies are dangerous and are going to, you know, develop all sorts of complications, but because our species has always done these things in groups of women. So I'd love to see groups of women forming and learning about their bodies, getting speculums, learning self-exam, learning how to visualize their cervix. Like my mentor Carol Downer says, you know, once you realize that cervix is 2 inches away and has a hole in it, it's a total game changer on how you think about abortion. And then moving from self-exam to practicing menstrual extraction and learning about safe self-abortion methods and helping each other with that. Because if we know how to do it ourselves, the authorities have a much harder time taking it away from us.
So there's a young woman listening right now. She lives in the U.S. She wants to take control of her own reproductive health and her own body, and she maybe wants to help some of her friends do that as well. What's the first step? What do they do?
I would recommend they start looking at all the information that's out there that's been left for us by our wonderful foremothers on how to do that. Some good places to start, there's a book called Natural Liberty by the Saj Femme Collective, and that is an incredible resource for women, where it covers self-abortion methods from herbs to acupressure points to vitamin C supplements, high-dose vitamin C supplements, and also details how to do menstrual extraction and early suction abortion. Also talks about how to safely use the medications. So that book has everything from, I don't have any equipment, I don't have any drugs, what can I do, to I want to take this further and help other women, like how do I assemble a home abortion machine? It's a great book, Natural Liberty by the Saj Femme Collective. You can get a free PDF online if you look for it. So looking for things like that, a woman's book of choices, a new view of a woman's body. There's a website called Sister Zeus that has a lot of information about this. And then realizing, again, like we have to heal ourselves from this hyper-individualism of capitalism and this horrible wound of patriarchy where we don't trust other women. Find one woman you trust and get to the point in your relationship where you can show each other your cervixes. And then you're going to be so, women who do that, their minds are blown and they really want to spread the gospel of self-exam. So that will, it will spread out in the community. So really breaking free from individualism and getting back into community is so important with learning how to do this, because we can't do this as individuals. We have to do this as sisters.
Thank you so much. Your work is so fascinating. It's so important. I was so inspired by your talk and by what you said today. So I just really appreciate everything that you do. And thank you so much for talking with me today.
Oh, you're so welcome, Megan. It's a real honor. Thank you.
You just heard an interview with Mary Lou Singleton, a midwife, nurse practitioner, reproductive sovereignty activist, and founder of Personhood for Women. I spoke with her last week over the phone from her home in New Mexico. That is all the time we have for today. I'm Megan Murphy. Thanks for tuning in to Feminist Current. You can find us online at feministcurrent.com, tweet at us at feministcurrent, or send us an email at info@feministcurrent.com. We are hosted by Libsyn, and you can subscribe to the Feminist Current podcast anywhere you like to listen. iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, Pocket Cast, TuneIn, and beyond. You can even give us 5 stars and a review on iTunes. Show the world radical feminism is worth listening to. Feminist Current is a syndicated show produced and edited by myself, Megan Murphy, out of Vancouver, BC. If your station would like to air Feminist Current, you can find episodes at audioport.org. And finally, if you enjoyed this podcast, consider making a donation to support our work. Just visit feministcurrent.com and click the donate button.